Welcome to this real-world theology extra of sorts. In April, I had the chance to lead a conversation on the movie Noah with the Greensboro Fellows. If you're not familiar with the Greensboro Fellows, it's an excellent program that I will have links to in the notes of this post. And I hope that you check them out, especially if you're a post-college kind of transitional in life type person who is looking to kind of get some life experience and some solid foundational things. It's a great program run by Trip Graziano, and I highly encourage people to explore that. But they brought me in because they were doing an apologetics course, and we were going to talk about engaging culture. And obviously, one of the main things that we do here on Real World Theology is engaging culture through the narratives that are shaping that culture, in particularly movies, TV, and stuff. So with the movie Noah, there was a specific opportunity to kind of have the fellows think critically in ways they may have never done before. And we get to do it in a movie that was creating a lot of conversations, both good and bad, for people they knew, people they were trying to reach, people that they had actually never had much conversation with it at all before, and with themselves, which was one of the most important things, really thinking critically for a movie about the first time and the impact that it was having. So what is to follow is not the best audio recording we've ever had as a large group of people, about 20 people, but it was our live conversation, having all seen the movie, kind of just working through some of the narratives, the themes, and how what the movie was saying and what they kind of got out of it. So I hope that interests you. I love to do this. I love to encourage other people to think outside of just the common podcast format. So give it a listen. See if maybe there's some ways that you haven't had a chance to think about the movie. And make sure you check out the rest of the post so you can learn more about the Greensboro Fellows and the great things that they're doing. So, enjoy.
This movie has definitely kind of caught fire in terms of interest from both Christians and people who aren't necessarily looking at it from a Christian point of view. If you had a chance to read the Christianity Today article on an interview by Christianity Today of Darren Aronofsky and his co-writer, Ari, I can't remember his last name. What was it?
Hansen.
But there were two things that Aronofsky said in that interview that really caught my attention. One was, he said, as I read the story of Noah, and as I read the Bible saying that Noah was righteous, one of the questions I'm wrestling with in this movie is, what does it mean to be righteous? Like, what is righteousness? Like, wow, like how many movies do you know of that are wrestling with the question, what is righteousness? So that's kind of a big, like, flashing something. I don't know what it is, but it's a huge question that this movie is wrestling with. And then another part of the interview, he says, another question I'm wrestling with is, why did God save anybody at all if he knew that they were going to be sinful again after they got off the boat? And so, in so many words, he's essentially saying, what's the point of redemption? Like, why does God redeem anybody if he knows they're going to keep sinning? So we talked in our last apologetics class, rarely does the culture offer up a softball like CNN saying, all right, Christians, everybody else get quiet. Tell us why you believe that the gospel is true, and then hold the mic in front of you. That rarely ever happens. What happens a lot more is things like this movie, which even in itself, from my perspective, is pretty rare. So that's why I've asked us to focus on this. I've asked Mikey to come in and do a podcast with us. We're going to load this onto NPR as soon as we're done and broadcast across the country. So,
should talk like this.
So be on your best behavior. But Mikey, thank you for coming out tonight. Mikey's really great at this, and I've had the chance to be on multiple podcasts with him. So I appreciate him coming out to do this. Mikey, tell us what you want us to know about tonight.
Well, a couple things that probably have to be said up front. Because of this is a fairly large group, I usually sit around a fairly small table with three or four people. This mic is going to try to pick up everything, but I'm used to projecting because I'm used to recording. Lots of you might not be. So if you want to be picked up at all,
you might need to just speak out. Don't be afraid to speak out. I want it to be informal. What I like to do is not sit and teach other people what a movie meant, but have a conversation about the things that we saw in the movie that we enjoyed or we didn't enjoy and why. I say that because what I try to do with the podcast that I do, that Elijah's been on, is we just want to engage culture. We want to engage narrative, we want to engage story, and we want to try to convince people not to simply go to movies to turn their brains off, be entertained on some level, and leave being like, man, that was awesome. Or, man, that sucked. Because I don't know why people want to talk like that. So what we want people to do is to really think about what they're watching, because I should have brought my notes with me. In 2013, I believe there was like $100 billion in worldwide ticket sales to theaters. So more so than most of your pulpits that you're going to see, these movies are being given free rein into people's lives voluntarily, not because their family went to church on Sunday, not because they're expected to be there, not because they're expected to stay awake during the sermon, because they chose to pay whatever people are paying to see movies these days, an exorbitant amount of money to see a movie. So they're making a choice to go to these things, and whether they know it or not, they're giving the power to producers, directors, screenwriters to either directly or indirectly influence how they think about themselves, about the world, and what we're really interested in, about how they see God and faith. Though it is interesting just to see what people think about their culture around them and stuff. Thoughts on forgiveness, justice, what is righteousness? And like Elijah said, one of the big things about this particular film is that we don't often have a movie that puts it right out in front of you. That says, these are the questions we're trying to answer. These are the questions that people are asking. And because we have that, this gives us a unique soundboard to begin lots of really great conversations. Ultimately, after I was on my first podcast, I think we came to the conclusion that this movie ends up being a win-win. And what me and some of the guys I was on with meant by that was, either you're going to have people going into this movie and they're going to really enjoy it, they're going to connect with some theme or themes, because story conveys things that just simply telling someone won't, which is why usually Jesus didn't say, hey, don't do that, don't do this, do this, don't do that. He said, let me tell you a story. And people are able to apply that in a much more broad yet connecting way. So we realize that those are connecting with people, so we can either ask really great questions about why, or people don't like the movie, or they want to reject the movie, or they're not sure why it sat with them wrong, and we can ask them questions about what theme they didn't like, how they see it different. In this particular case, since it's a movie that is steeped in religious tradition, both to some degree Islamic, Jewish, and Christian traditions, you can ask them, well, if this isn't the way to get conversation started, or if this isn't the way to engage with a culture around you by making a piece of art, then how would you suggest we do that? Especially since it just happened that this movie came out around a time where we had two other very blatant Christian films come out. I don't know if many of you heard, but there is a film that came out called God's Not Dead. It is a very straightforward Protestant message. Very typically Christian-made film, fairly low budget, some kind of B-list actors. The conclusions are pretty straightforward. There's no wrestling, really. This movie currently has a Rotten Tomatoes review ranking of 17%. So out of 100%, it's only people are not really seeing this movie as a great piece of art, so less people are engaging it. Same thing with Son of God. Son of God came out in the theaters. Its current ranking is 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, which Rotten Tomatoes, it sounds like a wacky thing, but as a movie reviewer, it's something I have to go to a lot. It comparatively, Noah, like I said, whether you enjoyed it or not, is trending at around 77% of like people liked it, or at least they thought it was a good film. So, and also comparatively, God's Not Dead made about $40 million, which, you know, is a lot of money. I wish I had $40 million. So I don't want to necessarily say that's failing. Son of God made $60 million. But Noah, in the 3 weeks now, I believe that it's been out, has made $250 million worldwide. So when we're talking about movies that are going to kick off conversations or shift culture or give us the inroads to engage culture, one of these movies gives us those avenues at a much higher rate than the others. So, with all that said, that's what I want to do. That's the perspective I'm coming from. And there's a lot of ways we can do that. Typically, I just ask people if they enjoy the movie or not. But based on Elijah's introduction and his real love for the fact that Darren Aronofsky, the director, writer, and producer of this film, gave an interview that he liked so much, I wanted Elijah to kind of throw out some of the first questions.
Oh.
See how I did that? Okay. I just talked for like 10 minutes, so now you get to talk.
Oh, okay.
Where will this, before you do questions, where will this be posted?
Wherever Elijah tells me to post it.
I mean, I don't have any specific place in mind. I was joking about NPR. But I mean, if you're comfortable, Mikey has a website called realworldtheology.com, I think. So if he wants to post it there, I'll leave that up to him. Or if he wants to share it with y'all and y'all want to post it anywhere, that'd be fine. So don't say anything that you wouldn't want to be on the internet, basically.
If it ends up decent, I'd like to put it on the Facebook page.
Yeah. The Facebook?
On the Facebooks.
Wait, I think it'd be cooler we should drop the.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering if I could barely hear you from 2000.
I think to be cooler, we should drop the
Wait, so, no, you're stuttering.
What was your site again?
Realworldtheology.com. It's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com.
Oh! In a land far, far away with many puns.
That's right. So, you can thank my wife for that.
Thistle, real world theology.
That's right. So,
Mark had a blast. Am I right? You and Mark
had
a blast.
What did you say?
No.
Why are you inquiring?
Okay, I'll get us. I'll help get us back on track. So, thank you for the joking. It gave me time to think of a question that I wasn't ready to ask. So here's the question. It's a question specifically about the movie. I think in the movie there was a key turning point in the movie where the whole movie changed. Noah's character changed. The storyline changed. Everything changed. What do you think that moment was, and what was it about that moment that changed Noah? How did Noah change in that moment? I've seen the movie twice now. I wouldn't have been able to identify it as clearly. It like was stood out to me as plain as day the second time I saw it. I remembered it from the first time, but it wasn't as clear the first time. But what do you think?
There are only right answers.
Recording.
Yes, we are. Yep. I record way before everyone thinks I am.
You would do that.
No. So.
Should I help give a hint?
Well, I think
I feel like.
I mean, I can jump in on that.
Speak.
It seems to be when he is talking to his grandfather. And he goes into some kind of a, I guess you can call it a trance, you can call it some kind of a visionary state. He gains clarity. There seems to be a pivot point. Mm-hmm. After that, obviously, he plants the seed from the Garden of Eden in that rocky soil, and you get water that comes out. I mean, obviously, that seems like a pivot. Is that what you're getting at?
It is I'd call it a development point. I wouldn't call it the key. I wouldn't call it the key hinge of the whole movie. So let me partially answer my question so that we can be on the same page and then ask a follow-up question. So early on in the movie, Noah's gotten a vision from his grandfather, Methuselah, And he's going back and he's telling his family, and Noah's saying, God's going to save all the animals. And one of his kids says, and what about us? And Noah kind of shrugs his shoulders and just smiles and says, well, I guess we get to go too. So he has this positive disposition towards the ark. The ark is a place that his family's going to be redeemed as well. And then he meets this girl as they're running away from the men who are coming to attack. And he picks this girl up and he saves her, which contrasts right with the later scene where he leaves the girl. So his heart early on in the movie is he saves the girl. He tells his family they're going to get to go on the ark too. And by the end of the movie, he is ready to exterminate his whole family or any possibility of them procreating. So what has so here's a better way to ask my question. What has changed in Noah? What was the key change moment from, I'm going to save the girl, I'm going to tell my family they get to go on the ark too, this is a hopeful message, to, I now have to kill my family because something so terrifying has happened to me? What was that moment?
I would say when he goes to the village.
Yes.
And he sees really the evilness of mankind. He sees,
yes,
the man selling women for meat.
Yes.
People murdering each other, the fire raining down, the the ditches of bodies. And I think that's really when he realizes that man is evil, that man's first nature is to do evil and not to do good. And so his thought process is that because man is so sinful, the animals are not sinful, so therefore the animals may live, but my family can't, because we're just going to keep on sinning and destroying each other and killing each other.
And he sees himself in the evil,
yes,
people. He sees a man, you know, selling a woman and then grabbing the meat, and then the man turns around and it's Noah's face. And so he realizes that God isn't actually saving. God is not wanting to save his family too, because he feels like he's no better than the evil people in the village.
Exactly. And why did, fill in the historical background, why did he go to the village in the first place?
He was getting wives for,
yes,
his sons.
So remember, he's cutting the wood with Ham, and Ham says to him, you know, Shem has a woman, what about us? And it kind of hits him like, huh, well, yeah, I guess I should go find. So he's going with good intentions, hopeful. And then, does anybody remember what? He stumbles back into the boat in the early hours of the morning, and somebody asks him a question. Does you remember what he says in response to the first question he's asked? Somebody says, where's the wife? He's, there'll be no wives. That was the solidifying thing of. So what is it? So here's the question: what is it that changed in Noah's heart? I think y'all are already answering that. And how does it relate to redemption? Like, when he saw evil, how did that, seeing that evil, answer the question of redemption for him?
You just jumped right in there, didn't you?
Well, you told me to ask a question.
You asked a question, not ask like a theological. You're doing this all wrong, Elijah.
Go ahead, Mikey.
No. Well, I want to get us there, and I'll say it this way. Okay, so that scene that Elijah was talking about you guys are describing, the realization that man is evil, where did that sit with you? Like, was that disturbing?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, did you disagree with that? I mean,
I didn't disagree with it. I really did not enjoy watching the movie. But a lot of times, no, all the time, I really hate movies when they're overly violent and overly, mm-hmm, cruel. Mm-hmm. And I didn't enjoy necessarily watching it in the movie, but I know that it was for a greater purpose.
Well, I guess that's something that I have heard from some people, because it almost seems like in this movie day and age, the cool thing to do, the chic thing to do, is to take something that you've heard 100 times and make it grittier, make it darker, make it more brooding, and then people will go see it. I mean, a bazillion people went to see Batman for the, you know, basically the same reason. It was pretty dark the first time, and it got even darker. So, but what I want to say is, like, what were your perceptions of the story of Noah beforehand? And, like, do you think that your perception was wrong or that the movie went too far?
Are you asking that directly?
I mean, because she was talking, I was at point. But, I mean, like that's...
Well, I think, I'm thinking about the Christianity Today article when he asked him, or when he talks about the storyline, or maybe I'm getting in articles mixed up, but I read a lot of articles today.
There were a lot of articles.
But one of the articles talked about how if you're looking like chronologically like at Genesis, and it goes from in this order of creation and then fall, and then all of a sudden it jumps to Noah. And so, and that's the part that like Aronofsky like has allowed like freedom to develop whatever he wanted to develop within that. And with that, like looking at the evil that he created and envisioned within that time period is like of how it got so bad that like the Lord wanted to rid and cleanse the entire earth. Now I lost my point. Shoot.
I mean, but was that like, was that as dark as you thought it would be?
Oh,
like when you read read through Genesis, do you ever really think about that?
No, not at all. I mean, no, absolutely not. Like, especially getting into like cannibalism, like that was like huge. I was like in my mind watching it, and I was like, oh, it's disgusting. But what if they really did that? Like, what if that like that's it made me think a lot about how evil was that time period. What was it, or was it exactly how we are today, and we're just as evil as that time period? Are we doing the exact same things? And that God has that same righteous anger built up inside of him that he would love for everything to be just and stuff that goes on with other things. I don't know. So that's kind of...
Well, the good thing about the conversation is it can go wherever it needs to go. So don't feel like...
Okay.
If you have
except where I want it to go, right?
No. you want to skip right to the end.
Well, one thing I thought was interesting in terms of Noah feeling complicit in the evil of the earth. Witnessing is the blood of his shoes. Mm-hmm. I mean, he saw himself while they were. Let's
in a vision or
no? And when he's standing there, and of course, he's seeing them. They're not eating meat; they're ripping an animal apart. I mean, let's be honest; it was this vicious kind of thing. And then he saw himself in that man. Actually, that reminded me. It kind of was reminiscent of how the demons kind of show up in the Passion. Passion by Gibson. It's flicker. They appear.
The 100% biblically accurate Passion of Christ movie by Mel Gibson.
You know, it was quite accurate according to some Catholic traditions.
Okay, there we go.
I'm not going to argue for or against its biblical whatever. When he saw himself, he saw his own shoes. He saw himself covered in the blood of what was going on. There was this complicity of it. He was complicit with all of it. He was standing there. I thought that was interesting.
How many people, before seeing this film, their only real interaction with the story of Noah was, like, in Sunday school coloring books? I mean, like, or singing, like, Arky Arky, you know? Yeah, or, you know, like it being a children's story.
Yeah.
Noah's got a big beard and he's happy. He's basically like mini God. The boat's all pretty and all the animals are smiling. No one really dies. I mean, no one's trying to get on the ark at the last minute. It's it's painted as a very happy story. But something the Father Thomas McKenzie, who was on our podcast, he said. That really struck me, even though I felt like I knew this already, was that besides the crucifixion of Christ, this is probably the most horrible thing that happens in the entire Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you don't really get to see what it looks like to have to sit by while the entire planet is wiped out. And I think that shifts your perspective. And once your perspective shifts, you kind of have to deal with that. I mean, did anyone really get stuck on any of the scenes when he was in the boat listening to the cries of the people outside?
Yeah, that part definitely, affected me, because, like, If we talked about this before, but if I was him, yeah, we'd be grabbing ropes and throwing them out, and there's still room here, we can pull people in. But I mean, yeah, I was thinking, like, at my church in the children's room, they have this big mural of Noah's Ark, and all the animals have smiles on their faces, and Noah has a smile on his face. And it's like, I never thought about that until I saw the movie. And right before I saw the movie, I read through Noah, through the story. And I was like, this, when was the last time I read this? Like, read the entire thing. Like, it had been years, I think. And it was a lot darker than I remembered. I never thought about the people. And then watching the movie, like, it's things you never thought about. And if Noah really did have a smile on his face, then he's a sociopath or a psychopath. Because, like, all these, the entire world is dying. Not just the humans, but also the creatures, all the other creatures that aren't on the boat, all the trees. Like, the entire earth is gone, covered by water. So why would anyone be... So why would anyone be smiling about that?
Nothing's exactly right. Well, like, did anyone, I mean, was anyone really disturbed by the interpretations that were made at certain points, or any particular point? Or was there anything that, like, an interpretation or an extrapolation of a particular point of the movie that you thought went too far or was ridiculous? That's what normally in our podcast, we would call our, come on, that's just out of left field. That really made you wonder if this guy had actually read the Bible.
Well, I found myself not really holding the directors to a biblical standard because, I mean, from what I understand from his interviews, he drew from a lot of sources, and it's not necessarily like him looking at the biblical account and seeing, like, okay, so there's room for creativity, so I'm gonna, you know, imagine things into it. He used different sources outside of the text, and in my view of it, it seems like he's synchronizing a lot of perspectives from the Jewish tradition and from I don't know, the Torah, the Midrash, a bunch of different things, and so I guess I had a lot more grace to how accurate it could be to the biblical account. But I did realize as a Christian, seeing the narrative interpreted as it was, it did make me feel as if there is a level to which I know what the true story is according to Scripture, and what does that look like when truth is not presented to the world. So, but nevertheless, I don't think I really held it to the standard of, like, the directors must be accurate in their portrayal of the story.
Well, no one would not have been allowed to talk if you had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are some very interesting things that I think are either said in Scripture or heavily implied that were left out, that I think probably made it a more family-friendly, apocalyptic, scary, intense movie. Because lots of people's biggest problem with the Watchers or the Nephilim, which basically get one verse in Genesis, that verse basically heavily implies that some type of being comes down to Earth and has sex with human women, and they procreate. And I mean, I didn't see that in the movie. Maybe someone else.
Were you looking for?
And also, we have a very interesting scene at the end of the movie with Noah, drunk and naked on the beach. And there are certain ways that you can interpret Scripture to wonder exactly what Ham did that would cause him to be cursed, and his entire line to be cursed for all eternity, instead of just being like, hey, I saw my dad naked. Because usually that probably won't mean you're and your entire line is cursed forever. So there are some things that left out that actually could have made this movie a lot, could have pushed it to R instead of PG-13.
So let me ask you a question about your question to everybody. So you asked about moments that we recoiled against or moments that we didn't like. I want to ask about a specific moment. I think it's actually a string of moments. So, Ryan, you mentioned him seeing the blood on his feet, seeing himself in the face of the man, seeing the evil in his own face. And I think the logical conclusion to where Noah takes that in the movie is, I have to kill my grandbabies so that they can't have children themselves. So my question is, and let me say this, I think Aronofsky is tapping into something in terms of how, in particular, the evangelical community sees sin. And kind of our catchphrase is, no sin is better than another sin. I'm just as bad as you are. I'm just as guilty as you are. So is Noah's conclusion, or is the conclusion that Aronofsky brings Noah to, that he has to kill his grandbabies, do you recoil against that conclusion? If so, why? And if not, why not? Is that a fair question?
I would say so.
Okay.
It's pretty deep.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to keep it.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Who thinks Noah should have killed his kids? Or killed his grandkids?
You have to recoil at that.
Yeah.
Why? For truly evil, what
would
we...
Who would not recoil at the idea of killing one's grandchildren?
No, I mean, I agree with you. I agree with you, but there's some logic to it.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
So what makes it...
Yeah. I thought that was one of the least... Like, that's when it trailed off for me. One of the parts that really turned me in my stomach when he decided that he was going to kill the grandchildren. For several reasons, but I think the main reason was when he didn't kill the grandchildren, he looked up as God and he's like, I can't do this, as if him sparing a life that he obviously created and knit it in his, and I forget the act, Emma Watson, what, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You forgot about Hermione?
Hermione, whatever.
That's a woman question.
What, whatever. It was created and she was no longer barren. In the context of the movie, I have a problem with her, that where the two other wives come from, air quotes, you can't see me, audio, but so, I do.
We're just trying to keep it biblically accurate. They were on the boat, their wives were on the boat the whole time.
No, that's not the question, so I'm going to avoid that real quick. And then so it seemed to me that he was saying, made me lose all my humor.
That he was
made
becoming
lose.
God by making the choice.
Yeah, and so if Noah didn't rebel against God, then mankind would have been over, and like, thanks Noah for continuing the line of humanity. When obviously if God wanted to end humanity, then why would he tell Noah to bring a boat or even make the boat? And there's a few other things.
Because the animals can't build the boat.
But there was no animals on that world. So, like, if they were all dead, he brought them all back. Just in the cohesiveness of a cinematic movie, I thought that was kind of a weak point. There's no animals, then God creates all these animals to put them on a boat and kill all the rest. I'm like, why bring them back? Just kill them all except for the two. Just
why would he create man if he knew man was eventually going to be sinful and he would want to destroy them?
We are his prized possession. Yeah, I'm alone.
Yeah, I think what disturbed me about it was for Noah to do that meant he was the exactor of justice or mercy, and for him to see himself evil and for that to be enough to give up the whole ruse meant that at some point he'd transition in his heart to being the hope himself for humanity rather than what God could do, not just for him but through him and his descendants. And he had transitioned from an object of mercy and hope to exactor and embodiment of mercy and hope in that moment. And then that's when he lost hope, is because he realized he couldn't do it and it wasn't in him. And responsibility completely shifted in that moment in his own mind.
And he got depressed and drunk and isolated himself from his family. Like, that's
Which, he wouldn't be the first person who thought that God gave him a clear command and did not fulfill that command and basically hid because of it. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but one of the conversations Elijah and I had was, I mean, does anyone think it's unreasonable for God to have asked Noah to end humanity based on what he showed Noah?
You mean to kill his grandkids?
Well, to let his entire family die off.
So whether with a knife or just...
Whether to either kill them right there or to let them die off in general.
So you're asking, was that unreasonable?
Yeah.
Are you absolutely confident that that is what God has communicated to Noah?
That is a great question.
Yes.
Which is, I think, what the crux of the actual end of the movie becomes when he has his conversation with Ella, which is Emma Watson's character, because Noah's beating himself up the entire time because he thinks he's let God down. But depending on how we view God's interaction with humankind, how he speaks, and how his will works, is it entirely possible that God selected Noah because he knew ultimately that he would follow him to the point all the way up until not killing his grandchildren. So Noah actually did exactly what he was supposed to do. He just didn't see it right.
Well, it is interesting, though, in the movie, Noah is a murderer.
He is.
Mm-hmm. He kills
people.
Hundreds of people. with his bare hands. I mean, right. You see... I mean, I thought the scene of the people rushing toward the ark and being smashed by these giants and by Noah, like they were all ants, was disconcerting, to put it lightly.
But why?
Because human beings have value, and here we have this picture of them just being squashed like insects.
But they were all going to be drowned like insects.
It's better to be drowned than squashed.
drowning is probably a much worse death than...
It probably is, unless you're Methuselah and you have your berry. but I don't know. That I thought that was disturbing. And it's not as though, I mean, if Noah, of course, I didn't want Noah to kill the babies.
Mm-hmm.
But if Noah had, it would just be continuing what he'd been doing for the past 100 days anyway. His character had become one of, he had blood on his hands. Lots of it.
To do God's will, though, right? Or what he interpreted God's will as.
There you go.
How many people in history can we look at that we would call heroes kill men, women, and children because God told them to and we have no problem with it? Let's just look at the Old Testament. I mean, this is...
I think we should have a problem with it. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Or one of the things that I thought was a really great parallel was... why would God ever ask somebody to do something like that? Meanwhile, he asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac after Abraham, waited so long to have Isaac. Now, given in that, we have a slightly different story. That once Aronofsky makes that film, we can start taking apart all the stuff that happened in that moment. But it's not like this is necessarily out of character of God. And I think Elijah actually may have said something on our podcast. I think it was you. I want to give you credit for it if you like it.
Oh.
If I misquote. But, our understanding of what God's justice is much different. And usually if we have a problem with it, it's because we're implementing our own justice or putting our own justice on that situation. One of the things that, like I said, I'm wondering if people have really wrestled with is what does it look like? Or how hard is it to really follow God when it looks like he's asking you to do something that doesn't make sense to everybody else? You know, like, if you graduate college and people are like, go get a job, and join the workforce, get married, have a family. And you're like, no, I'm going to go to Greensboro. I'm going to serve a city. I'm going to, raise support, take a class, not really make any money. Huh. How do you explain that to people?
I don't get it.
Yeah. It was a parallel.
Random.
Yeah. I'm grasping at straws here. That's what I see in Noah's character that I did not see in the actual Bible text. Another thing that did anyone have a problem with the fact that God did not speak to Noah?
You mean verbally?
Yeah, verbally. Or audibly, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in the Bible it says God spoke to Noah. I don't know if that's literal or how he spoke to him. But in the movie, I was bothered by how Noah had a dream that I was like, what? I knew what the dream was supposed to be saying, but I couldn't even interpret the dream. So, and then he had a hallucination with Methuselah. So, God not speaking to Noah was...
bothersome?
Bothersome.
Have you ever felt God speak to you?
Not audibly. Like, I've never heard a voice from heaven say, Andrew did this.
Does that make Noah's interaction with God more relatable?
Yeah.
To our understanding of...
It was a lot more relatable to me that... because I was wondering how they were going to have a voice from heaven speaking now. Like, is it going to be like... Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, Morgan Freeman was busy that week. He couldn't do it.
Like in Prince of Egypt when they had Val Kilmer voice both Moses and God to have, like, God is the voice inside your head. But instead it's dreams, and it kind of reminded me of Joseph and Daniel. How they had dreams, and then they had to interpret the dreams and figure out what God was saying. And so, it definitely reminded me of that, how Noah and Methuselah are interpreting the dreams and hallucinations and trying to figure out what God is saying and what he wants Noah to do. And so I don't know where I'm going with this, but I definitely found it more relatable that God didn't speak audibly, but instead he spoke through dreams, whispers, voices inside of Noah's head, messages, signs, Noah seeing himself in the people and whatnot. And so
putting himself at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. So that's definitely more relatable and modern than a random voice coming down from the heaven or a bush catching on fire.
Which is weird, because I think often we assume like the voice of God is this thing that we assume can't happen because it's magical. Yet the movie still chose to have elements of mysticism or magic, you know, however you want to choose to interpret those things. Like I said, it's very ambiguous. I think it is a big deal that they chose to interpret the text. Noah's still getting all the things that he got, you know, from God in the text, in the movie. He just got them through, like, circumstance, being led certain places, wise people speaking into his life. I mean, basically all the ways that I look for someone to help me interpret what God wants for my life.
But it seemed like the whole movie was an attempt for him to understand what he was supposed to do. Which I think is quite realistic. I mean, if you're the only one who claims that God says this to you, and no one else is confirming it, that might be an issue. I'm reminded of a professor who used to say, if someone comes up to you and tells you that God told them to do something, grab your wallet, because if they'll lie, they'll steal too. what he meant by that was to be careful of people who seem to have these individualistic interpretations.
They have their two-way radio to God?
Yeah. That's not confirmed by
anyone,
any community whatsoever.
Well, and when you say that, I find it interesting that in the movie, we have Noah getting these dreams, and immediately his wife comes out to him, and is like, okay, this is what we got to do. Through all the prep to the ark and getting on, people are all confirming, even, you know, the Nephilim come alongside him, and they confirm what he's doing. His wife is confirming.
They were watchers, they weren't. Called
well, the Watchers, who are the interpretation of the Nephilim.
Yeah, or they could be from another source, actually.
The Enoch?
They're from Enoch.
Okay.
Because the Nephilim are... That's a weird verse in there. Right, down, having sex with women and producing giants. Yeah, strange.
So, very strange. So, the Watchers, if that makes you more comfortable.
It's just a movie.
So, the Watchers, you know, confirm it. His family confirms it. You know, Methuselah... by aiding and being ready for him, confirms it. And then it's not until he changes and starts to thinking that all of humanity needs to extinguish even his line, the line of Seth, that people start pushing back. He's not getting any confirmation except from himself. He's become isolated. He's like I said, he's the guy that will take your wallet because he's all of a sudden determined in his mind. He can't explain it to his wife. He can't explain it to his children.
Methuselah seems to get it.
Well, Methuselah still chooses to help the other thing.
Right, but it does seem like there's various aspects of it. He gets this part.
Mm-hmm.
He gets this part. I don't think he gets the whole thing until maybe the end. Emma Watson helps him with this.
Yeah. I don't think he gets it. Well, I don't even think he fully gets it until the end. I think he understands that it's not as bad as he thinks at the end. And so he's trying to go along. But I believe, Skyle, you talked about this when you first, one of your first comments. We have this Etch-a-Sketch kind of do-over of humanity. And like 2 chapters later in the Bible, we're talking about the Tower of Babel.
Mm.
You know, so what good did it do? And I think one of the areas that Elijah and I have disagreed on up to this point is that
I'm about to convince him though. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. You do. You think. I don't think we're going to actually hit on that. But one of the reasons that I really enjoyed this film, I enjoyed the story that they tell, is because based on the Jewish traditions of the Midrash and extrapolating some of those things, while I don't think that's probably exactly how it happened, or you know, the Watchers were rock creatures, et cetera, et cetera. That's neither here nor there. What it does is by the end of the movie, it from a Jewish tradition point of view, tries to answer that question that Darren Aronofsky says he's trying to answer about why would God not just send a flood every 100 years? And I don't necessarily think they answer that question, which is why when I got up and walked out of the theater, I basically said, thank God that he had a plan and that he wasn't going to have to do this again and again and again. And I think more than anything else, the lack of answer at the end of this movie points to the need or the necessity for a savior, for true redemption and true justice, and ultimate mercy. And like I said, that's one of the things about examining story. It doesn't have to have all the answers. We can really learn a lot from almost any movie. I mean, we're gonna talk about Captain America on my podcast in a couple of weeks. You know, we talked about Monuments Men. We talked about Despicable Me. You know, every movie is telling a story and it's teaching us lessons, or it's someone trying to interpret what they think about the world or how it works or how it should work. And like I said, the best part about this movie is it doesn't get the answer right, but it leaves us with proof that we need a better answer than currently the Jewish tradition has.
I would love to have people from different traditions hear in on this conversation, because personally, I left unsettled because there was a lack of an answer. I wonder if an atheist or someone who has a humanistic worldview would leave thinking, wow, that was refreshing, because we do have the power to extend mercy to each other and continue on in a way that has a semblance of the garden. And so I wonder how incomplete it would be to someone who doesn't subscribe to the Christian worldview, if that's something we really can say, that as a sweeping observation or a sweeping judgment on how people leave the theater, or if that's a just typically Christian evangelistic way that we leave the theater.
And that's one of the reasons that I really enjoy what this movie is doing, what Elijah hinted at the beginning, because if you have a movie like God's Not Dead that gives you an answer at the end, especially an answer about Christianity that ties a bow on something,
right,
is almost never the way life is. There's almost nothing in my walk with Christ, and I guess y'all can correct me if y'all have these perfect Jesus walks that I don't know about. But it's never a black and white, everything turns out perfect story.
I think that's a slippery slope, and this is the quote by Aronofsky in Christianity Today. He ends it with saying, in all the Midrash tradition, the text is what the text is. The text exists and is truth and the word and the final authority. But how you decide to interpret it, you can open up your imagination to be inspired by it. And so, for me, I left that unsettled thinking, wow, I could interpret that a million different ways and in ways that could both be beneficial to others or harmful to others. It could have God as the one giving mercy or me as the one giving mercy. And I think it's easy to go down a road either way with that train of thought.
But either way, you're having a conversation that you would not have been having otherwise, because your atheist and humanistic friends are probably not going to see the Son of God.
Right. Yeah. That's true.
And so, you know, I just want to highly encourage all you guys. Like I said, I try really hard not to look at movies as a good movie or a bad movie anymore. I try to look at the story and what it's saying. Now, there are certain production values, certain cinematic qualities that may fall short. You know, sometimes people are not very good at telling stories. But there's always something there that someone's trying to convey.
Let me ask a hypothetical question. So if you were the director of this movie, knowing everything you don't like about this movie, knowing everything that you would want to be different, what would you have changed in the movie? How would you have made it different? And how would you have done it in such a way that it wasn't what Mikey is describing, kind of the stereotypical perfect bow on the end of the perfect Christian movie that everybody's smiling against, which gives the impression that Christianity's not real, right? Because I know that's not my life, so...
It's Hallmark Channel.
That's Hallmark Christianity. That's not biblical Christianity. So, think for a minute. You're the director now. What would you do differently than what was done?
Yeah, because we have basically two schools of thought. And everyone's pointing to this middle ground that no one can seem to find, because there's like, well, you have to either do what Aronofsky's done in this film, or you have to basically have Kirk Cameron sitting on a stool reading the account of Genesis and the movie ends, you know? And like, everyone points to, why can't it just be good and biblical, and why does it have to be so far this way? So what would you do?
Or to use your word, if that wasn't biblical, then what actually did happen in the Bible?
Well, this doesn't answer the question at all, but I'm just going to say it because I wanted to say it earlier. Really, really bothered when so-and-so of Cain, what was his name?
Tubal Cain.
Got on the boat, because then it made it seem like anyone could get on the boat and that the Lord didn't shut people out. And then when he took the snake and he bit it, I don't know why, but that like really made me very angry. And then he gave the meat to Ham, and I was like, why is he doing that? Like, no matter how mad you are at your dad, like, and I don't know why, but that entire part of it struggled the entire way.
Do you think you weren't supposed to be mad about that?
I wonder if that's supposed to be like a layering on of like the temptation scene in the garden, where Satan tempted Eve to eat from the apple and basically pervert her.
I'd take it a step further, and I'd say it to me is a parallel of when Satan is actually tempting Christ in the desert, mm-hmm. using the words of the Bible to try to get him to do things that weren't true. Because we see Tubal Cain in that whole series of events, quoting scripture, saying things that are true, but not the way that Tubal Cain is using them, because Tubal Cain is using them for his own self-interest. He's not, you know, God didn't give us dominion over creation to abuse creation or to be self-serving of creation. We're to be stewards of creation. So, I mean, like I said, to me, it's like, it is a throwback.
But look, I mean, I think we should be careful, though. Noah only gives the first creation account from Genesis. So chapter 1 up to 2:4. We only hear the second creation account in Genesis.
right after he's bit the head off of that snake. So it's interesting that they have the two creation accounts that we have launched in Genesis coming from competing interests. Noah says nothing about anything from chapter 2.
Well,
all chapter 1.
I would say that he implies some of those things at the beginning of the movie when he's talking to Ham, saying that, you know, we only take what we can use and things like that. He's, instead of saying that they were given dominion and stewardship, he's showing. But
I don't know. I think that was one of the brilliant moves in the movie, was to be honest, to say that the various accounts of creation we have in the scripture may have come from different places and have been put together for us in the final product. So I don't know. I thought that was quite powerful to juxtapose those two creation accounts. And to be really honest, that there are two, right in Genesis. I mean, it's you can even see it in the English. You don't need to be a biblical scholar to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I think is most mystifying to me, or to put it positively, here's, I think, one of the greatest questions this movie's raising specifically for Christians. Like, why did God save you? And is he unjust to save you and not save somebody else? Did he save you in the first place, or did you save yourself? So, similarly to what I said in the class on Thursday, I think this movie raises tons of questions about the justice of God, the mercy of God, how we relate to that. And I think Aronofsky's putting those questions to us in very visceral ways that we recoil against them, but I'm not sure we always know why we're recoiling against them, or why don't we just join God? Like, should we be killing, if all of us have sin in ourselves, shouldn't we just be killing other Christians to help get rid of evil? Like, that's kind of one way you could take Aronofsky's interpretation of what Noah is doing. So to me, it raises the question of what does redemption look like? So if Tubal Cain's the guy that shook his fist at God and shot a firework at God, and Noah's the guy that said, oh no, there's evil in me, so I've got to join God in killing everybody. If those are the two approaches that Aronofsky presents, so I personally don't think Aronofsky ever presents redemption. I don't think he ever does it. Even at the end, the end ends with Ham walking off and saying, maybe we'll learn to be kind. And then Ella says, maybe you can help us be better, Noah. Like, come out of your cave. Maybe you can help us be better. So none of that is redemption, in my opinion. That's all some version of self-help. None of that's pointing to a God who redeems. And so Aronofsky doesn't go there, and maybe he was going to go there, and the producers changed it. Who knows? But I don't think there's any way to do justice to the judgment of God and the mercy of God without talking about redemption. Like, any explanation that you attempt to give is automatically going to go where Aronofsky goes, unless you can point to a God who redeems and a God who doesn't automatically tie a pretty bow on things, but he does give hope. Like, Noah never really seemed to have hope to me, because he never really knew anything beyond his own power to save or to kill. Anybody agree with that or disagree with that? disagree with me, Mike.
Matt agrees with you.
Do you agree with that?
I saw a Noah at the beginning of the movie that I thought really believed and really had a lot of hope.
What did he really believe in?
The provision of God.
He does say that, doesn't he? God provided the...
everything.
The ark and the animals. Yeah. So here's what...
it's not until he starts misinterpreting the will of God that he starts turning from that provision.
Well, no, here's what's interesting that I think applies to us today. What threw Noah off was seeing evil that he didn't think God could redeem. So the reason he rejected wives for his sons, because he thought those wives would bring evil on the ark. He didn't believe that God could redeem those two new wives and, like, bring a new creation out of it. So,
well, I don't even think that he would say they're bringing the evil. I would say that the evil was already going to be on the ark. They were just tending
right,
to the rest
right,
of
right.
creation.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So evil was already on the ark, yeah. But, so how does that apply to us? Like, what happens when we see evil? Like, do we either go hide in our shell, or do we give up on the world and say, oh my goodness, it's just gone crazy, I'm going to go hang out with my whatever group I feel comfortable with? Like, I think it raises these challenges of how true is redemption? Like, is God really redeeming or isn't he? And do we just put our head in the sand or fight against it or join the judgment? Or do we look for this third way, this new creation that Christ is bringing? So we got tested for Noah, I think, and I think he failed the test. Like, he stopped believing that God could redeem.
I wonder if in the beginning he believed in his own need for redemption. Like, I wonder if he saw himself as righteous before that or not. At some point, he saw himself as more evil than he thought he was when he saw his face on that guy. And so at least the degree of evil he saw himself capable of changed, and then changed his ability to see himself as redeemable.
And I wonder, too, how watching his dad get killed in front of his eyes affected that. We talked about this on the podcast. There's two parallel scenes where Noah's dad says, men hide. And then later Noah says to his kids, men hide. The difference between the two scenes is Noah's dad got his head whacked and died. Noah pulled out an arrow and killed the men. So they both, Noah learned to fight men, whereas his dad was just a man of peace. And so I think there was a sense where he felt like he, seeing his dad get killed, he had to fight against men. You don't agree?
Say something, Matt. The podcast can't hear you.
The only thing that I would say is all human art ends in incoherence. And I think what Elijah is pointing to is that the only coherence that comes, and this is a major hermeneutical position, I suppose, for this is how I would come to all the scriptures, and I think is the Christian way of addressing the Bible. The only coherence that comes to the scripture is when Jesus Christ is brought to bear on it. So the fundamental question that Aronofsky and Henson bring up in all their interviews is, we were looking at this word righteousness and saying, what is it? And from their Jewish background, it's a balance of justice and mercy. The entire account of Noah is an account of justice and mercy. Justice in flood, mercy in ark. That's what it is. And the problem is that those two tensions cannot be resolved. They're incoherent without Jesus, essentially, without redemption, true redemption. And that's why the movie feels empty, and there are all kinds of problems if you look at certain... I think the character journey of Ham doesn't make sense. I don't think that... Like, if you look at what Noah's wife says to him, this is what justice is, and her voice breaks and she's crying. It's a pathetic human arguing in the face of truth. Noah stands calmly. He's absolutely right, and is that where I would disagree with you? Of course we recoil when we want to kill grandbabies, but it's inexorable logic. And there's no coherence if you say, oh no, those little babies are really just fine. That's not, then you're saying, no, the wickedness that Noah saw in that scene where all mankind has fire raining down on them is a truth. They're mutually exclusive. And in Jesus, God's wrath, his justice is perfectly demonstrated and perfectly satisfied, and his mercy is completely fulfilled, because it's something that Jesus is the true ark, and he's the true flood. And that's to me what this any time that you engage with story, you have the opportunity to come to Christ in the end, because he's the coherence that God brings in the face of all human incoherence. So that's what I would say.
But I think it's kind of what Tripp was getting at earlier. Kind of, you know, your imagination can kind of take you almost anywhere, and it's good when, which is why I want people, hopefully, coming from our particular cultural and religious perspective, to engage these conversations. because as much as you can interpret scripture or interpret story in many different ways, or like I said, a storyteller, the screenwriter, I mean, heck, just a writer if you're reading a book, directors, anybody who has a say in how the story is told, they either have their own agenda or their own questions they're asking or trying to answer or think they have answered. And, you know, based on the interview, I would say that I think Aronofsky has answered that question in his eyes. And if people leave without us engaging and being like, even though you can interpret story different ways, there are truths that don't change no matter how you tell the story. And one of those truths is Christ, which is why, like I said, I enjoyed the fact that there wasn't a resolution, because I think if there was a resolution, they would have been telling a story that was illogical and unfaithful to their cultural Jewish perspective.
So let me reinterpret a little bit what you're saying. In some ways, you're saying God intentionally does not resolve the story of Noah.
I mean, I don't think he did.
I agree with you. Like, yeah. The Tower of Babel being the very next scene is like, wait a minute, there's no resolution here. And then what's the next scene after that? And wait a minute, there's no resolution here. So if you look at Scripture, I think one of the things God's doing with us is he's keeping us in this perpetual place of hope and yet not complete resolution. And even now we're in that moment. Like, we're in the Ark of Christ, but we don't have a resolution to tons of things. Like,
right, but isn't it, I mean, if you're looking at the story in the biblical context, there is resolution. It's with God. It's not with humanity.
How so?
It's with God's coming to realize that he will work with his sinful humanity, that he won't destroy it. I mean, I think that's a powerful juxtaposition before and after the flood story.
Bring some process theology in?
No, it's not process theology at all. It's just being honest to the biblical text itself. You see God beforehand saying, I'm going to wipe this place clean.
I regret.
And then he's
going
to say, I'm not going to do that. That's not process theology at all. You don't need Claremont School of Theology for that. But you've got this resolution in God that he's saying, I'm going to work with these people despite their sinfulness. Now, is that a change in God, or is it a change in the way we tell the story about this? That's maybe up to the interpreter. But
well, according to Elijah, there's nothing we can do that affects God.
That's okay. That's podcast.
That would be
the exact opposite.
Exact opposite. Yeah.
Yes, but it's interesting, though. There seems to be a resolution in God's resolution to work with us.
Now, how is God saying that he's going to work with us after the flood?
Well, I mean, there seems to be, if you look at it in a larger context, I mean,
he already said he was going to work with us before the flood, right? Because he said Noah.
Well, he says, I see that the world is evil.
Right.
And want to wipe it clean.
Mm-hmm. Except for Noah.
Well, then we see this, yeah. It's like this, I think that's a pivot point.
Yeah, so I think God was always intending to have a plan of redemption because he said no. He didn't say I'm going to destroy everybody upstream. I am going to save one family. So there was always a plan to save Noah. So the question is, why did he even save Noah, I think? Why was that even part of the plan from the beginning? And I don't think that's resolved, seeing that the story pretty quickly degrades again. And so I think, similar to what you were saying, Matt, that the lack of resolution, it's eschatological. It's always pointing to the future. It's like, even now, our hope is in the return of Christ. Our hope's not in this present moment, as sweet as this present moment is. And so, as much as we crave, I think that's why people don't like the bow tie movies. Like, it's promising something that we know intuitively we can't have yet. Like, I still struggle with depression. I still struggle with fear. I still struggle. What were you going to say, Skyline?
I said Disney movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's why Frozen did so good. It's because Pixar made it.
Well, it did so well.
Well, yes. So yeah, I think there's something to this question of resolution not being satisfying yet. Mm-hmm. Like, we're satisfied in Christ, but we don't have ultimate satisfaction.
Yeah, I felt that same lack of resolution even reading the passage. Like when God calls Noah righteous, I want to be like, all right, go ahead and tell me why he's righteous. Why is he righteous? Why is he right? It's not there. It just says he was righteous.
But he even says he's righteous in his generation.
In his generation.
Which means comparatively, he could have been right. He could have been scummy compared to most of the other righteous people.
We don't know what it means. All we know is the only thing we do know is God attributed righteousness to him. And that, you know, my human nature, I want to be like, all right, I want to know what that is so I can go do that. And it leaves us still like feet firmly planted in midair, other than trusting in God to declare us righteous and to seek him out on what that is.
Well, we've gone about as long as Elijah wanted to, but I wanted to give anyone else a chance. If there's just anything that you wanted to say or point out or debunk or laud.
I was just thinking when Elijah was talking about resolution, the quote from Donald Miller blew up jazz when he's talking about how he used to not like jazz music because it never resolved. And that was his problem with God, was that God never resolved, and life never resolved. And so I think that's just something that's really fundamental in life is the lack of resolution, and even in culture with jazz music, the lack of resolution. So that's my two cents on that.
That's good stuff.
That's really good. When you were talking about moving into a time of greater and greater darkness, greater and greater grittiness, it's almost like that approach to culture and to movies is wanting to up the lack of resolution, or it's wanting to up the dissonance. Like, I'm going to get your attention so you come see my movie by upping this angst, this darkness, this feeling of being unresolved. So I think one of the challenges for us as Christians is to recognize that there are things that aren't resolved, but to be able to hold to the things that are resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not going to agree with you that everything's up in the air, that darkness is just going to up, and that darkness is, and grittiness is going to have the final word. Like, so it's unpopular to say some things are resolved. Christ has died for sinners. There is hope of salvation. Like, those are resolved things, truths as you call them. And to know what to hold on to so that you don't let go of stuff, like I think Aronofsky has. I mean, probably was never holding on to it in the first place. But yeah, I think that's a great question for us as Christians, is like, how are we comfortable with things that God hasn't resolved? But how do, in the face of saying that nothing's resolved, how do we truly hold on to what has been resolved?
Which is why I like what kind of Matt brought in there before he fell asleep. that you know, like, there are certain things that we know, you know, and that you can't look at story without taking into account some things that are just true. And I believe that the tricky part, especially with this movie, is that it's a movie based on some scripture in the Old Testament. And as Christians, we look at the Old Testament as basically every story pointing to Christ. So it's hard for us to reconcile this movie not pointing to Christ. And that's good. That's a great thing. And like I said, that's why I encourage everyone to, if you see someone talk about this, you know, talk to them about the non-resolution, or do they think it resolved? And show them where that resolution is at. I mean, in a kind, relationship-building kind of way, you know, but...
Not without a dagger, right?
Well, I mean... Come up, you know, tell them they had to do it, and then kiss them on the forehead and tell them about Jesus at the last minute when the music climaxes. So, but anybody else besides Elijah? So it did there.
That's all. No, that's cool. I'm going to call you out and say thank you.
Sure.
Well, if no one else has anything else, I'm going to close the actual recording of this so y'all can start swearing and doing whatever else, you know, 20 some people year olds do. But thank you for being a part of the conversation.